Welcome to another special edition 8-point roll episode of AviatorCast, celebrating National Aviation Day, August 19th, 2015. So we have another snippet episode here coming from Oshkosh, which I attended, gosh, now almost a month ago. But this is a pretty cool, different sit-down interview with some different people that are still involved in restoring and flying the P-51. I didn't do this interview myself. This was in Warbird Alley at Oshkosh. This is called Warbirds in Review. They do this twice a day where they have a different airplane with different people. Really, really cool presentation. And you will hear my voice at the end. I do get up and ask a question. And it was actually, I felt like a really good question there at the end of this. I asked the guy basically what it was like to fly the airplane and if he ever felt like he was taken back in time in history to what it was like to really fly in that day and age. So anyway, really cool. I hope you guys enjoy it. Again, this is between mechanics and people that fund this and people that fly it of P-51s. So really cool. These guys were sitting in between two P-51s that were flanking them. And there was just a lot of questions going back and forth. So I hope you enjoy it. Here is P-51 in Review.
At the end of World War II, though, what happened to your airplane?
Our airplane was in theater for about 30 days. And on June 10th, it was a training accident. And that was the end of it. So it was in combat for about 30 days.
And where did it go after that? Was that the end of that airplane?
Yeah, for the most part it was. The real Berlin Express survived the war. Bill Overstreet had it. It was given to another guy. And then at the end of the war, they used training pilots
and
to...
And Bill Overstreet flew with Bud Anderson 357.
Yep.
Small world.
It is. Small world. So, yeah, so our airplane ended up being buried, basically. Yeah. And until we got it back in 2009, we got the... Got the airplane and got started on the restoration.
So, Eric, talk about the restoration process. Talk about parts. Do you have to take the whole thing apart and start from scratch with all the pieces?
Yeah, with CRSU, this particular airplane, we started with a complete airplane, which in today's world of restoring some of these fighters, that doesn't always happen. And that's one of the big things that makes this airplane behind you so special is because the metal you see here is the metal that flew over Belgium and Germany during the war. And so we were very fortunate that this airframe had actually stayed together almost entirely through its whole life. And we knew that. We weren't certain of it. But after we acquired the airplane and brought it up to the shop and disassembled it, we were able to identify components by serial numbers and research and found that the majority of the airplane was the original airplane, and it really just added to the desire to really do an authentic restoration, which for us meant every rivet came out of the airplane, literally every rivet of every component.
So when you look at those parts, when you took it apart, are there parts that you know you can use? Are there some you know you cannot use? And do you have to identify
them? Well, one of the things that I like to talk about is with an airplane like this, there's really a focus on restoration and kind of that word and the definition of it, and rather than rebuilding. In other words, because of the airplane and the history, we really wanted to make sure that we were saving and preserving the same airplane. Sometimes it's easy when you take every part of the airplane apart and you say, well, let's just, you know, throw this away and throw this away because we can make a better one or find a better one. And pretty soon what's left of the airplane, that's the true airplane. And so there was a lot of attention to that definition of restoration and effort. And, you know, there's parts in the airplane. There's one wing rib that I can think of specifically that clearly the wing had never been disassembled before, and there was a rib, and it had a repair on the nose of the rib, and it was the only rib in the wing that was bare metal, and it had a stamp on it that said repaired. And I think in a lot of cases in a restoration, you might just, well, let's put a better rib in there, but that was important to preserve that and save that. And so that's very, very important point with Sierra Sioux and our restoration process, with a focus on restoration and preserving the original airplane that was there.
Chuck, talk to us about the engine.
Well, I think Eric's probably better qualified, but it's a Packard-built Merlin 1650, and it's been redone by Roush Engineering. The rework is to not to increase horsepower, but to increase longevity. And they do great engines. It started right up. They come with, what, 5 hours on them? So,
John, the restoration of your airplane, how much of this sounds familiar to you, what you just heard from Eric and Chuck?
It's very familiar. We've been in business for a very long time, and we've done a lot of airplanes that have flown in, or, you know, so on and so forth. It's kind of, nowadays, it's every restorer's dream to get an airplane that's complete, you know, something to start with. There's something there. With Berlin Express, we got the airplane, and there was, we tried to save as much as we could. There wasn't a huge amount of what was left. And so, you know, from there, and what we do is, you know, we go out and we try and find as many original parts as we possibly can, you know, castings and fittings and everything that we can, and then we have to, you know, restore and piece back together this B model Mustang. So it is, it's you know, it's a labor of love, and you really do, you get into it, and all the original parts you get, you look at them, and they're this color green, or they have this stamp, or they have this sticker from this certain manufacturer, and you know, you go in and you either try and save, or if you have to restore the part, then you restore it back to what it looked like when you received it, you know, that inspection stamp, or that particular inspector and his number that was on the stamp, and then the sticker or the decal or whatever was used back then, we come back in and restore that part so that you have a picture of what it looked like old, you have a picture of what it looks like new, and they look exactly the same. And it's some of the fun things for us and our guys, and you know, the passion that everybody takes, and I'm sure that they're the same way. You know, you go to work, you're excited, you get to do this stuff, and it's preserving history, and for future generations, it's just awesome.
Now, it was your airplane Overstreet was allegedly flying under the Eiffel Tower. Is that story, and how true is it?
Our particular airplane is not the airplane that flew underneath the Eiffel Tower. Bill had, over his course of two tours, he had four Mustangs. And so everybody's seen the picture of the one that's silver and it has a locomotive. That was his first airplane. And this airplane, when Bud Anderson went home after his first tour of duty, he gave the airplane to Bill Overstreet. And so what Bill did was he took Old Crow off and he put Berlin Express on the side. And so that's what we did, was a second airplane. And the story of him flying underneath the Eiffel Tower, we've done a huge amount of research. We've tried to talk to family. We've talked to him before he passed away. We had the very huge honor. He was a very big part of our restoration, and he was so excited, and we're so disappointed he wasn't able to make it. But to answer the question, yes, he did fly underneath the Eiffel Tower. Yes, he did.
What was he chasing?
He was chasing an ME-109. So the story, as the best way he put it, was he engaged an ME-109 at 30,000 feet while escorting bombers, and they tail chased for 30 minutes, just back and forth. Everything he did, the German pilot had an answer for. But you get to a point where you start running out of ideas, right? And this guy's just not getting off your tail. So this 109 guy ended up coming down over Paris thinking, because at the time, Paris was occupied by Nazi Germany. He was thinking that all the AA and all, you know, Paris was a very heavily defended city, would take out this Mustang. Well, that didn't work. So that as a last-ditch effort, this 109 guy came around and ducked underneath the Eiffel Tower, Bill right on him. Shot him down right on the other side. There's a big open green park. The 109 ended up down there, and you know, because of that, it gave inspiration, it gave hope that to the, you know, the people of Paris said, hey, you know, Americans are coming, you won't be occupied forever, we are trying. And it gave, from what everybody has said, is they partied in the streets for 2 weeks of this one event. And the French delegation came over here to the U.S. and gave Bill Overstreet the, I can't remember, it's a big, long French name, but it's basically their Medal of Honor. And he received that Medal of Honor from the French people. So it's a pretty cool story.
Well, John, let's talk about, are they white wall tires on your airplane?
Yeah, on this airplane, what it was Bill Overstreet and Bud Anderson, they had convertibles. Bud had a Ford and Bill had a Buick. And they had convertibles. They had red rims with white wall tires when they were training in Santa Rosa. And when they went overseas, it was something that they could bring from home. You know, people talk about nose art or your sister's name, your mom's name, girlfriend's name, whatever. And that was something that they brought over for their airplanes. So those two airplanes, Old Crow and Berlin Express, they painted their rims, red rims on the outside, and then they did white wall tires. So it's authentic to the airplane.
Talk about, Paul, if you can, or you guys, about the history of the airplane D-Day stripes. And why were they painted, when were they painted, and were they changed at all? Who wants to grab that, Eric?
I can talk about the D-Day stripes a little bit. This particular Sierra Sioux does not have the D-Day stripes. Berlin Express does. And we've been involved with some other D-Day stripe invasion painting, invasion stripe painting here at Oshkosh a couple times. Neat story about the day before invasion of D-Day, of Normandy, there was an order put out for all the airplanes that were to take part in the invasion to have the black and white stripes painted on the airplane, and the invasion was pushed back a day, so they did have an extra day, but they thought they only had basically one night to put all those stripes on. And you can imagine a huge airfield full of every airplane, transports and fighters and bombers, and every airplane had to have those stripes. So they were applied with brushes and mops and done simply in black and white, because those color paints would have been easily accessible. So they were typically put on very crudely because they had to do a whole airfield, and you kind of get that why when you actually do it yourself, it takes time to lay those out and make them straight and make them look good. But they had a heck of a lot of airplanes to do in really short notice, and so cooks and everybody was involved with that. Yeah.
John, D-Day stripes?
Yeah,
what was the purpose of them, first of all?
The whole purpose was, you know, you're doing an invasion of France. And so you have a massive amount of ships and people and troops and everything. And the whole purpose was they put these black and white stripes on. So when these mass gaggles of airplanes flew over the top of all of these battleships and PT boats and whatever they had, you know, destroyers, everything that they had, they weren't getting shot down. So that was one of the big reasons for invasion stripes. And, you know, like Eric said, it was a mad dash. There's a paper signed by Eisenhower, and it says, all fighters and medium bombers are to have black and white stripes painted at 18-inch intervals. And I've got that piece of paper, and it stated, like you said, you know, you had one night on June 5th, the night of June 4th, actually, to do it. And the weather was so bad, and honestly, thank God, because we did. We had one day where all these airplanes had black and white stripes on them, but the weather was over. It was overcast. It was bad weather, so the Germans didn't have any photo recon to come in and say, hey, you know, all these airplanes have these stripes. And so, you know, yeah, on D-Day, on June 6th, they had all these airplanes with full invasion stripes, top of the wings, over the fuselage. And then they figured out that, hey, look, you know, we're going over there. The Germans are picking us out easier because they can see the invasion stripes on the top of the airplane. And we're getting, you know, they're getting jumped, they're getting intercepted, they're an easier target. So then they go ahead and they go back and go, all right, we're going to take these off. And so they flogged the invasion stripes with gray and green and whatever to get them off the airplanes. And then they'd go back over and start getting friendly fire from the ground, because guys on the ground are looking up going, there's no invasion stripes, so they start shooting on them. So they reapplied them on the bottom. And so in the case of Berlin Express, what they did was they did full invasions. They went and did the invasion of Normandy, and they came back and they took them off the top. And we have all the photos and everything. And so they took them off the top of the airplane only. So if a German pilot was looking down on the airplane, they're only seeing green. You know, they're not seeing these big black invasion stripes, because they do. They stick out.
Chuck, talk the nose art. How much color photography was there of these aircraft to allow you to reproduce the nose art in color accurately?
Of this particular aircraft, there was none. So what we did, we found some members of the squadron, and they told us that the lettering was red and blue, so we knew that. And we have two pictures. They're actually over there. One of them, the one on would be on my left, is the nose art with Robert Bona, the pilot, but it isn't complete yet. And the other one is, we think, the next day or later the same day, and it is complete.
And you'll notice if you look very carefully, there's the lightning flash that Max is painting does not appear in the first one, and it does in the second. That's how we know about the completion. And for a long time assumed that the what are white highlights in the lettering were just natural aluminum. But the process of trying to figure the colors is Max would paint on aluminum, and then we would photograph it in black and white and then compare, and you just have to keep working for the color values. Another one that we found out at that time, we had assumed, and if you look at the pictures, there's a bar across her chest. I like to call it a modesty bar, but it looks black in the black and white pictures. And it's really, we determined in this process that it's a dress fringe. And it's brown, because you can, if you blow them up and work real carefully with the gray tones, you can figure out, you can compare it to the black letters. That's specified by the AAF. We know those letters are black. And if it's lighter than that, it can't be black. And one more thing about that I think that's kind of interesting. There's a symbol on the front of that, what I just characterized as a modesty bar, that's a 7 and an L and a bar underneath it. For the life of me, I couldn't figure out what that was. And we put together a gathering in Sonoma, California, and met the family. And I asked Susie there, can you tell me what that is? And she says, oh yeah, that's the family cattle brand. And they were cattle farmers and still are cattle farmers, cattle ranchers, excuse me, they probably kill me for saying that. They were ranchers. Not only that, they still drive cattle 60 miles up into the mountains with horses in spring and back to this day. Their family, not Susie specifically, but and sitting next to her is Christina, who's Robert's niece, and she does indeed drive cattle up and back. Show us, lift your hand there, Christina, so we know where you are. Christina Gonzalez.
We hear about B, C, and D model Mustangs. What's the difference between them? Who wants to grab that? John?
I'll take that, yeah. One of the big differences is the back of the fuselage. I mean, you look at Sierra Sioux and you look at Berlin Express, you look at the fuselage, they're totally different. And at the time, you know, if you look at that time period, you know, the P-40s and the Thunderbolt, everything had this Razorback. And so when they did the Mustang, it was the same way. They designed this frame canopy and they did this Razorback deck on it. And so over the period of time, you know, they started going through it. And as the wars, you know, you start getting into the later part of 44 and the D models start coming out, they cut down this deck, they put the bubble canopy on, and they changed things for what they learned in combat with the airplane. And so that's one of the big differences is with the fuselage. One of the other big differences is the wing. So the leading edge of the wing, if you look at a gear leg inboard, it's, you know, if you look at Sierra Sioux, it sticks out quite a bit. And on the B model, it's almost straight. And one of the reasons for doing that is it's less drag. But at the same time, the slow characteristics of the airplane change. I've been very lucky to fly both, not this airplane, but I've flown stock D's with armor plate, and I've flown B's, and the slow speed characteristics of a B model Mustang is not half as good as it is with a D. And that's another big difference. You know, and then you have a lot of subtleties where there's some stuff in the cowling that's very different. The gear doors are different. The one other giant thing is the gun bays. On the B and C model Mustangs, they had 250 caliber machine guns on each side, and they put them in at an angle. One of the things they figured out was you'd start pulling G's at high altitudes and really cold temperatures, they jam. And they fixed that when they went to the D model. They put 350 caliber machine guns upright, and they changed the whole chute system, and it stopped or helped prevent a lot of this jamming issue. And then they also extended the gun bay in the D model. So the ammo bay that holds the ammo itself, it holds a whole lot more than a B.
Eric, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think you hit most of the differences. There's maybe some of the other smaller differences you'll see is hardware and radio packages. Some of the controls in the cockpit are a little bit different, gun sights. But we hear that question a lot too, you know, when people come and ask us about Mustangs. We're currently restoring a C model, which is the same as the B model Mustang in our shop. So we get that question as well. And really the tail, from the tail back, is kind of my easy answer for people is the landing gear are the same. And from what we call the production brake, which is that big line that you see right in front of the vertical stabilizer and the horizontal stabilizer, kind of from that back is basically the same, but there's differences there too.
Yeah, from a pilot standpoint of the airplane, like he said, cockpit layout's different. The one of the big things, I'm kind of a shorter guy, and so when I fly a D model, it feels a little bit more cramped. The instrument panel is a little bit farther forward, and you have this really cool feeling. You sit in the B model, and the instrument panel is actually 2 inches farther forward. So when you sit in a D, the instrument panel starts to hit you about here, and so you know you're moving the rudders and whatever, and you get a kind of peripheral vision of where you're at. In the B model, the instrument panel hits me down here. So it's a big difference. The cockpit feels a lot bigger and more open, especially with the Malcolm hood on it. There's allows a lot of light in, where the D models, it's a little bit more confined, but it's also, again, it's an upgrade. You know, everything they learned in World War II, and they started, hey, we're going to do this. Between what they learned in combat, what NACA was figuring out with the test airplanes and so on and so forth, and then including the British too.
What, in terms of firing the 50 caliber machine guns, in terms of time, how long could they shoot those guns, and to what extent did they have to shoot short bursts, and why?
If you hold the trigger down, it's roughly about 20 seconds of ammo. On the D model, there's actually one of the two inboard guns have more ammunition, so they will keep going. So you'll run out of ammo on four of your six guns, and then you have a little bit left on the last two. We actually had an opportunity with one of the past restorations, Twilight Tier airplanes that we restored. We were able to get all the permits and get live firing 50 caliber machine guns and set them up and experience that. And it was pretty awesome thing. Of course, the airplane was on the ground and tied down and not flying, but yeah.
What made this airplane? I mean, we've all heard and read that the Mustang really changed the outcome of the war once it came online in like 44. What was it about this airplane that was so much better performance than P-47 or any of the earlier aircraft that used to escort the bombers?
I might add one thing with that is what we hear is that not only it just really flew good and ran good, but leading into that, the systems work good, the airplane was reliable, and then probably another big factor, kind of when we have that discussion, is North American. They really, really knew what they were doing, and they knew how to build a simple airplane. We realize that we also have a P-47 in our shop that's being restored, and North American really knew how to keep the engineering simple, you know, kind of the KISS slogan of keep it simple, stupid, you know. The things were not over-engineered. They engineered things so they were easy to produce, and they just, that's one thing that's really impressive to us with North American products. Not only did they fly good, but they knew how to build them and build them quick, and everything was built well.
How significant was the turbocharger?
Yeah, no turbo on the Mustangs, but it had a supercharger, and that was a big improvement to have the Merlin engine that had two stages as well as two speeds on the supercharger and allow them to get way up and into cruise and get that longer range.
John?
I'll just add to what Eric said, you know, on both things. You know, one of the things that changed the Mustang, that reason it is as famous as it is and changed the war, was it carried enough fuel to go to Berlin and back. You know, it could go and it could escort those bombers all the way there through all the flak and all the fighters and everything and then come home with them. And that was, I mean, talk about a morale boost. You're a B-17 guy and the Thunderbolt peels off and you're kind of out there on your own. And then you get these Mustangs and they go in there with you and they come back. And I think that was one of the biggest reasons that airplane, from that standpoint, is as successful and popular as it is because of morale, and the airplane would go there and come back. And, you know, yeah, like you said, to fly the airplane isn't an amazing experience. You know, you take off and it's fast and it's got that feel and it's just an awesome experience. And then, you know, onto the engine, you know, the two-stage, two-speed supercharger was an innovation. It's just an amazing innovation.
One other thing too, it just dawned on me as well, is that's unique with the Mustang was the laminar flow wing. So it was really the first production fighter.
What's that mean? Well,
the laminar flow wing is when you look at the stand up at the wing tip and you look down the end of the wing, You'll notice that the shape of the wing, the fattest point of the wing is actually very far back. Normally, you think of a typical Clark Y J3 Cub airfoil, and the fattest part of the wing is very far forward. And on with the laminar flow wing, that the fattest part of the wing is aft very far. And almost all jets have a laminar flow wing, and that was a big. I think it was there was a, some several combinations that clicked that made the Mustang so special. And I know that's one of the check boxes, as well as the engine and that laminar flow wing, the ability to produce them so quickly. But it's kind of an interesting. There's really kind of an interesting story about that development of the laminar flow wing. But one of the things that's unique about a laminar flow wing is the smoothness is very critical to how it works. With the Mustang, there's a specification in the drawings that calls out to profile the wing. And it tells you that for the first 33% of the wing, it needs to be absolutely smooth and profiled. And so that's the reason on a D model Mustang where they went to a where they stopped painting the airplanes and everything was bare metal, they continued to paint the wing on the P-51. So if you look at Sierra Sioux and you kind of wonder, well, why is the fuselage bare and the wings are painted silver? That's the reason, is because they, and we actually did the same thing and used the same type of compounds that they used to fill in the seams and the rivets and everything. That 33% they tell you to go back to and smooth it out, and then after that you don't worry about it. So if you look close at Sierra Sioux, you can see the first third of the wing is very, very smooth, and then after that you can start to see all the rivet heads. They're still flush, but they didn't have to be absolutely perfect. And so kind of an interesting thing about the Mustang, that airfoil.
John?
I mean, Eric's absolutely right. Basically, the airplane was the next generation. When you look at nowadays, you got the F-16, and then you have the F-22, and it's that next step. And you look at the P-40, and then the Mustang came out. It was that next step. And one of the other, you know, it is. Between the engine and the prop, the laminar flow wing, which is an amazing design, and the scoop. The other big attribute to the Mustang was a scoop. The scoop is, the way the scoop is designed is it's half of a laminar flow wing. And the way, and another testament to North American engineering was, the scoop created its drag. It hangs off the bottom of the airplane, creates drag. But between going through the oil cooler and the radiator and all the heat, it creates a certain amount of thrust. And that thrust cancels out the drag of the scoop. And so that this airplane can take off, and instead of having the drag of a scoop like the P-40 does or P-38 does, you know, it actually creates this very small amount of thrust when the door is in trail, and it eliminates that drag of the scoop itself. So the airplane, it's an engineering masterpiece, and North American did it again with the F-86 Sabre. You know, they absolutely had an engineering masterpiece. And you can see with the Mustang and its evolution of airframe, you know, right now we're talking about World War II and what it did, and then you see it goes into Korea, and they did a few more mods, and then it goes into the racing world. You know, take airplanes like Strega and Voodoo that have the same wing. It's cleaned up, it's cut down, but the airplane aerodynamically is almost perfect. It's as close to perfect as you can get, and to go racing with that airplane is the same way. It's just a phenomenal platform to reach speeds that you need to go to.
Paul, how did you come to want to do this, to restore this airplane? How'd that happen?
Well, it was kind of a process in itself. I knew that I wanted to acquire the aircraft from Roger Criscow, not only because it had been a Minnesota airplane for a long time and I was a local guy and wanted to keep it in the Minnesota area, but to also take, like Eric had said, a very original aircraft. I mean, there's just not a lot of them out there, and take this opportunity to move it forward. Well, as we took this aircraft apart, Doc had it. We had a going away party for it. He looked at me and said, you know, if you just tune that carburetor up, you can fly it on up to Bemidji. And I said, well, that won't be happening, Doc. We're going to be taking it apart and put it on a truck and off it goes. And he said, well, I guess that's all right. I'm the only guy that ever wore a Mustang out. But we went through the process of really trying to decide how far do you go. There's a trade-off of, you know, how much you invest in these treasures of the United States of America,
and what comes out of it. And I got to tell you, these guys really nailed it. I mean, we just kept going. Eric kept walking me through it. And I think just going down the path of what Chuck would discover, or Eric Trueblood, or the rest of his gang, it was like, it was a puzzle. And it had so much history to it, it was just fun to keep going and going. So I kind of envisioned where we were going to end up. They did 110%, and I got to hand it to Air Corps Aviation.
Now, do you fly this airplane?
Yes, I do. Oh. And it's wonderful. It's my second Mustang. I flew Little Horse previously, which was a aircraft that was built out of parts. Mark Tisler was involved in that, and it also was the lead on this aircraft, and it was quite a bit different. This has all the armament and all of the radio equipment, and in my opinion, it actually is easier to fly. It's a heavier aircraft going down the runway where you can go up to a max power, and it tracks down the runway, although I think I saw Doug Rosendahl standing around here, and he's done the training for me. He said, yeah, anything, the heavier it is, the faster it comes down. So there's trade-offs in that, but it's a wonderful aircraft to fly.
So how fulfilling is this for all of you to be part of this? I mean, it's obvious this is a great part of your lives. You're nodding.
I'm smiling.
Yeah, exactly.
I think the most fulfilling thing that happened to me is, I don't want to do the whole story, but Robert Bowen had a crush on a girl in high school, and it was unreturned. And he named it Sierra Sue because it's named after Susan Lang, but there was a movie, Sierra Sue, at the time. So he didn't have to explain this unrequited love. And for up until about 3 months ago, I looked for Susan Lang. It's a very common name. And we enlisted the help of somebody in Bemidji that was really good with Ancestry.com. And we found her family. And one of the most fulfilling things was dealing with the Bona families and calling this lady, Susan Hayward, and saying, yeah, we know something about your mom that you don't know, or it was an airplane that was named after you. And so the next day they bought tickets to be here. They'll be here on Saturday. And that was just a wonderful feeling to be able to do that for somebody. Wow.
Yeah, this is just, you know, being up here to me is a dream. You know, it's fun. I have my kids here this year, and I was a kid here once and dreamed about working on these airplanes and being involved with them and you know, just walking around. I mean, I would spend, you know, just all week dreaming in the Warbird area and beyond, you know. And so, yeah, I pinch myself a lot. I get special opportunity to bring more people into it, having a business and you know, having lots of work to do. And that's very rewarding for me as well to see other people that are really interested in these airplanes and the history and keeping them alive and bringing them into it and giving them the same opportunity that people gave me.
How much of your knowledge, all of you, is school learned in terms of engineering, and how much is just learned on the job training?
Well, I mean, as a mechanic, you have the great opportunity of going to colleges. They have an A&P program. I was lucky enough, I went through Idaho State University, went through their A&P program, and you know, they really teach you a broad base. You know, you learn a little about a lot of things.
And then vocabulary.
And when you get into these airplanes, you know, you work with different guys, you apprentice under different guys. I had the great honor of being able to apprentice under Mike Nixon of Vintage V-12s and Jose, and learn engines from them. And then, you know, I got to learn airframe stuff from my father and guys like, you know, like Steve Hinton and all these other guys that are in the Warbird industry that are so knowledgeable, but they're willing to share that with you. They're willing to like, hey, you have a question, call them up. Like, oh, yeah, you just do this and that, and you learn. And it really is, it's a specific trade. It's very small. And the only way to really learn Warbirds is to work on Warbirds, to, you know, go and work for a company or work for a museum or the CAF or whatever. But it's, you know, you can go to your local college and get at least an A&P license.
Yeah, we get that question in our shop often with people that are, come in and see what we're doing, and they say, do you go to school to work on old airplanes? There is no school. For me, I'm just a high school graduate. I didn't go to any school after high school. Just really knew exactly what I wanted to do and did everything I could to put myself in that position and gained all my aircraft mechanics licenses, inspector license, and all that, just simply through on-the-job training, and it can be done. You know, especially in today's world with access to the internet and information is at everybody's fingertips. You know, I think that's a really, really important thing for everybody nowadays, young people to get in and get their hands on it and get dirty and learn by doing. Obviously I've had several people in my life give me opportunities, you know, to learn and do those things and ran with them. But yes, there is no school for vintage aircraft and World War II aircraft, and but there is lots of good people, and I would say the majority of restoration shops nowadays and organizations and warbird owners are very open to young people and older people who have always wanted to do it, get interested and help out and get their hands dirty. Because I think if you ask anybody that's heavily involved with warbirds, they are very time and intensive, and they take a lot of work to maintain. And there was full crews of military men and women, you know, taking care of these airplanes during World War II and beyond. And so it takes there's a lot of opportunity to take care of these airplanes. So if anybody has interest in that, definitely.
I just want to add to what Eric said. I mean, you know, the fact that the people that were before us, you know, they're so knowledgeable and they're so awesome. I mean, basically, like, they want warbirds to continue. They want the next generation to come. And I think me and Eric, you know, we're kind of that next deal. And for those guys that learned from original fighter pilots, guys that flew Mustangs into combat, and they learned how to fly these airplanes, or they learned from the mechanics that worked on them in the fields. And we're so lucky to be able to talk to them, and they teach us. And then, you know, it's our deal to go and, you know, return the favor, teach the next generation and keep this whole world going, so that, you know, we want warbirds to last forever. And this is a way to do that.
And the Pauls of the world, and without somebody like Paul, who can buy one of these airplanes, you guys wouldn't have them to work on.
Absolutely.
Well, the bank owns it, but that's all right. I do want to comment that the camaraderie of these rebuilders and restorers is amazing. I've been around it for probably 12, 13 years now. And one of the sad parts about it is some of the really knowledgeable guys, we lose them in accidents, as we've known. And having the younger generation come up like these guys and taking the knowledge and moving it forward. And I think both of them recognize that they're constantly learning. I just learned something. I actually thought Eric was an MIT graduate, but that surprises me.
Eric, you want to respond to that or leave it alone?
I'll leave that one alone.
Okay. And we have a new part of we can get some questions from the audience. Dan, where's Dan Bolin? Dan, come get a mic here, please. This is Dan Bolin, the late Ed's kid brother.
That's correct. We're standing in the Ed Bolin Memorial Warbird area, and I'm so proud to be here. Because of my brother, my sister-in-law, Connie, I've had the opportunity to meet so many interesting people, not just fighter pilots, people that worked on them and everything, but also people like David Hartman, who has helped me immensely. I was the first moderator for this program. Connie asked me to do it, and I said, oh my God, I'm not comfortable with a mic. So I went to David, and I said, David, what do I do? And more importantly, what do I not do? And he told me. So thank you for that, David. A new feature we have here is the man on the street, and that would be me. And I've been instructed by my producer, John Tennyson, to pick three people from the audience to interview. So I want to interview Susie, and we're going to be on camera, Susie, so put on your makeup and everything. And then I like to have two more people. So did anybody in the audience have a family member that was in the 357th fighter group? Anybody here? What about any other fighter group of World War II? Okay, I would like to interview you, please. Okay, and one more person. And is there a young person here who is really interested in aircraft, or someone from England, or some person who would like to talk with me after the program? Anybody? And gee whiz, and I thought I looked pretty good today. Yeah, I'm going to take questions from the audience, but I'm going to get one more person, and that's going to be Mr. Denny Sherman right here, who's my friend. Okay, we're going to take questions from the audience, and I'm going to start right here at this section. We're going right down. I'm going to get one question from this section. Anybody have a question from this section? No? Okay. How old am I? You mean in age or in? I'm 70. Anybody over here? Yes, come on down.
You guys mentioned that the guns on the B were at an angle. So was the wing thickened on the D model to accommodate the guns?
No, I'm sure everybody heard the question. No? The wing's the same. The thickness of the wing, it's all the same. Why they designed it on an angle, I'm not 100% sure why they did that. But yeah, as far as the wing itself and that gun bay where the guns sit, it's the same size between the B and the D.
I've heard some interesting discussion online about that lately, and I think there was pages and pages and pages of people going back and forth and talking about it. We kind of just sat back and smiled because we've actually drawn in CAD the entire P-51 wing from the North American drawings, and there's an ordnance chart, and it gives both the B model, B, C, and D model is all on the same exact ordnance chart, and there's one little change on the bottom for the, like, we're talking about the leading edge cuff, if you will, or on the wing. So it's the same exact wing profile to the numbers, and the drawing can be pulled up and it can be settled with that. But yeah, no, it's an interesting discussion about that. Yeah.
Can you explain about the cuffs on the propellers? Did the original Mustangs have them? And what is the veil length? There's a couple different propellers I see.
Basically, there's four props. You look at the A model Mustang, it's Curtis Electric. You look at the B's and C's, and it's these cuff props. And then you get into the D, and you have cuffs, and then you have paddles, and then you have the K model propeller, which is an Aero Products self-contained unit. The big deal with the cuffs was as the airplane would climb up to altitude, 14,500 feet is critical altitude for low blower on the Mustang, and so you'd shift it. And you go to high blower, then you continue on up to, it could go to 42,000 feet. And one of the reasons that they did these cuffs, and we don't really have an airplane to look at, but right at the hub where the blade goes into the hub, it's round. And that round starts to come out and then it turns into the blade. Well, right there, there is no air. There's no air for that blade to grab onto and push back. And so with the Mustang, you'll see right here, carburetor induction, it's right there, right at the base of the airplane. And so what they did was that they get to higher altitude, they put these cuffs on, and it would take that thin air, and it would force it into that carburetor induction. And what that did was it helped sustain or improve manifold pressure the higher you got.
Yeah, so it's basically just working like an air pump, pump air into the induction. And you normally, it's the only airplane that I know of that has those cuffs and is not a radial engine. You'll oftentimes see those cuffs on radial engine airplanes, and that was to help cool the airplane on the ground or at slow speed and high power. And so those cuffs are there to pump air into the engine. Yeah, exactly. The root of the blade is round because it has to rotate and it has to transition into that airfoil shape. So nearby the center of the hub, it's very round and it really isn't doing much air. So that cuff is actually molded rubber that goes in a big, huge mold, and it's injected, and it's a big rubber cuff that's molded right over the top of the aluminum blade. So yeah, the Mustang propeller is a very difficult, the cuff propeller for the Mustang, very difficult to find and hard to reproduce propeller.
I think I'll just add to that really quick too. One of the other popular Mustang props, if you walk down the line, is a paddle prop, where it's round at the base and it gets really fat at the end. I've never really had or read a specific documentation, but what it was as the Mustangs were getting towards the end of the war, some of the airplanes would show up with these paddle blades, and what it was you're going from an airplane that's going to haul 550-pound bombs, you're going to put 2,000-pound bombs on it, and that prop is basically designed to pull the airplane off the ground, and it's more of a climbing prop. And so that's kind of where you start seeing differences in blades and different. You go into Korea and you kind of see the same. It's a mixed match between cuffs and paddles, but paddle-bladed airplanes do better with a heavier load than a cuff does.
Yeah, it depended on what the mission was, really, for the airplane, which prop worked better. And the props do, the design of the prop obviously has a big effect on the performance of the airplane.
Hi, my name is Chris Palmer. First of all, thank you guys for being here. This is really wonderful and cool to kind of step back in history. My question comes from a pilot's perspective. What is one of the most memorable experiences that you guys have had in flying the airplane where you feel that you've kind of been transported back in history, or you just have to pinch yourself that, you know, you're transporting yourself back into this cockpit that, or this airplane that had been used in World War II?
Well, the one that just stands out to me is my first flight from Bemidji down to Minneapolis, and it was a beautiful afternoon. And there's documentation that Robert Bona had actually shot at an ME-262 with this aircraft. And he apparently made the comment as he turned in to fire at the aircraft, that thing was going so fast that he didn't think the bullets even made it to the aircraft. And I was just flying along wondering what would happen if a 262 came along. I figured I'd get him, but so that's probably my most memorable. I do some light acrobatics in aircrafts, and doing acro in this aircraft has been interesting, and I love it. I try to fly in a very large box so I don't get myself in trouble, but it causes me to wonder the low time that these pilots had when they're actually getting into a high-stress situation. And I'm sure when someone's on your tail, you're pulling as hard as you can, and how they didn't unhook these things and actually... most of them didn't just end up in the ground, so that's my comment.
One of my more memorable experiences flying Berlin Express, had the great honor to fly Berlin Express, is we did a photo mission with the, we live in Idaho Falls, Idaho, and that's where we're based, and we're, you know, 20 minutes from Jackson Hole and the Targhee mountain range. It's just absolutely beautiful mountain range, and we went and did a photo mission with Scott Slocum, and he's a Bombshell calendar guy, and he just does phenomenal work, and one of his requests was, hey, you know, gear up. You know, you're a younger guy, and you know, I want you to gear up. I want you to look the part. And so we had the airplane was, you know, we're doing all this magazine stuff. So the cockpit was just totally stocked. And I had the Mae West on. I had the flight suit on. And I had all the stuff, you know, and it's overwhelming. That's a lot of stuff to put on, and it's hard to kind of move. It kind of gets in the way. You're not, but it, you know, we took off and we joined up and we're out over the Grand Tetons, and there's nothing out there that's modern. And I just got this feeling of like, this is what it was like to be back in World War II and you know, going on into combat, or, you know, not in combat, but going into combat, and you're all dressed up, and what kind of the feeling that they had, and the restricted movements that they would have felt. And it was a humbling experience.
You know, historically, as they were describing, you know, these guys going into combat and the challenge, most of those flying Mustangs were 20, 21, and 22-year-olds. And when you think about that and look around at our 20, 21, and 22-year-olds today and think what they did, it's really humbling to think about what they did in those days. Yeah, amazing. Dan?
The airplanes are just beautiful. I think OCD comes to mind when you look at them. But... you said you were doing a P-47. I was just wondering, is it going to be the same level, and when's it going to be here?
When's it going to be here? It'll be here as soon as we can. It'll be here on Friday. That's our joke. I'm not sure which Friday, but it'll be a Friday. No, the P-47. Yeah, that's kind of our specialty and our niche and our shop is the authenticity and reproducing, recreating, preserving. All those details, and so it is a Razorback P-47, and it'll be another bare metal airplane, so have a chance to see the difference between Republic and North American and the way they were. And so that's our niche, and Mazzola's niche as well is you know, that authenticity. So yeah, should look the same.
Gentlemen, Paul, Eric, Chuck, John Jr., thank you, gentlemen, very much. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you. What a pleasure.
All right, so you may have recognized my voice there at the end. That was really the only interview question that I can take responsibility for. But this was such a cool panel because, you know, it wasn't pilots from World War II that flew it during the war that were being interviewed. It was guys that are still flying it today and restoring it today and talking about some of the intricacies of having to do that. So very enjoyable. I hope you guys enjoyed it as well. So if you guys want to learn any more about this episode, go to aviatorcast.com where you can learn more. And then we will pick up from there. We have one more 8-point roll special edition episode left, and that is coming up next. We are going to be talking to CEO of NBAA, Ed Bolin, who NBAA is a huge organization that is in charge of everything business and corporate aviation. So we will get into that episode here coming up. Until then, throttle on.
5-8 is the short line, turn left heading 235, maintain 2000, runway 25 right, clear for takeoff.
Clear for takeoff, 25 right, United 580.